about 5 after 10. And I would like to remind the audience, if they would please turn off their cell phones. I will reach down and turn mine off. I was at a meeting yesterday. I forgot to turn mine off, and of course it rang. let the record reflect that we do have a quorum, and present are Representative Seaton, Representative Roses, Representative Fairclough, and myself, Representative Wilson. And Representative Gardner's just joined us. Now, this meeting that we're having today is the second in a series of meetings that we'll be having on health care reform. And I've asked several experts to come to us today, and in the future that we're going to be working on how we can, how they can, I guess, help us educate us on some of the issues concerning health care in Alaska. And I do want to mention that in the audience, we also have our Commissioner of Health and Social Services, Carlene Jackson, Jerry Fuller, who is our Medicaid and Medicare expert, and Dr. Butler, who is our Division of Public Health, and several other people I see out there also. So I thank you all for joining us today. And online we have Alice Raig, and I didn't pronounce your name right, Alice. It's, would you like to pronounce your name for me? You wanted to listen only, but Raig, maybe that would be better. You're with Health and Social Services. Barbara Hale is online, and one of our speakers, Laura Tobler, is online, and she's the NCSL presenter. So without further ado, Senator Fred Dyson has joined us. Fred, if you'd like to come up and join us in the up with us. Good. Wonderful. Thanks a lot. Okay. Last month we focused on the uninsured, and the purpose of our meeting today is to take a little look at the bigger picture. First, we're going to hear from our National Conference of State Legislators, represented by Laura Tobler. Laura will provide us with an overview of what other states are doing to address health care reform. And then the next two speakers will be Ken Thorpe and Jim Frog, and they're going to present different models that could change the way that we might look at health care today. So I hope that you will all ask questions. They've come a long ways, and all of our presenters will be present during the entire meeting. So if something comes up during a presentation and you have questions, don't hesitate to refer to that. And Representative Wes Keller has just joined us, and Representative Keller, why don't you come on up and join us? And Representative Guttenberg is online, so we do have quite a few people that are interested, and I'm glad to hear that. So it's my pleasure to introduce the first speaker. And Laura had planned to join us, and because of sickness, she was unable to. But she is a nationally recognized expert on state health care policy issues. Currently, Laura serves as the program director in the health program at the National Conference of State Legislators. She has been with NCSL since 97 and serves as the lead staff person on health reform, access to health care, and the health care safety net issues. Laura received her Bachelor's of Science in Nutrition and Biochemistry from Pennsylvania State University and her Master's of Public Policy from Rutgers University. And Laura's presentation, now, if for the people in the audience, there are presentations, paperwork up on the table right up here, and so if you want to make sure you've got them, then you'll be able to follow along. Laura's presentation is on pink. She's got two different ones. The first one is on your pink paper, and the next one is on your orange paper. So, Laura, can you hear us?
Yes, thank you very much for that nice welcome. And I'm so sorry that I couldn't be there in person, but, you know, life happens, and it's just nice to be able to be connected by conference call. Can you hear me all right?
We sure can. You go ahead and give us your presentation. And if it's all right, Laura, I'm going to have the members, as you go along, if they have questions, we'll stop and ask questions right when it's on our mind, when you're on a slide or something. I think we get more questions when we do it spontaneously like that. So I might have to ask you to stop every once in a while to answer a question.
That's fine. I also asked my colleague Dick Kauke to join me since I wasn't in a plane. I thought Alaska could benefit from his expertise as well. He's our financial healthcare cost. He also does work on prescription drugs and managed care and the private market health insurance system. So I asked him to sit in with me as well. So he's available also for questions as we go through the slides.
Now, would you pronounce Dick's name again and then tell us how to spell his last name?
I'll just ask him to do that.
Hi, it's Dick Kauke, C-A-U-C-H-I, and I do work, as I say, with Laura on insurance and a variety of other issues. I will say that I haven't prepared any material for this, and so I'm not sure that I'll have easy answers, but I'm happy to be helpful to Laura if I can.
All right, and when you speak, Dick, I think you'll have to speak just a little louder. We cannot quite hear you as well as we can hear Laura.
Okay, fine. I've just moved over to a closer distance here.
Okay, thank you. Go ahead, Laura.
Okay, well, you have my PowerPoint, correct? And so I'll just have you advance through the slides as we progress. So the first slide just gives you my contact information, and I'd just like to offer to the committee that NCSL would be happy to help Alaska as it journeys through health care reform. And I am available by email, phone. I'm sorry I couldn't be there today, but if there's another meeting that you find would be useful to have someone there in person, please do call and set that up because we're here to serve you. So that's my contact information. And the next two slides we won't talk about very much, but it's just really to set the stage of why so many states are right now contemplating broad-based health reform. The first slide shows the health care cost per resident by country, and it shows that the United States has the highest of those. And then the next slide is health care as a percentage of GDP by country, and once again, the United States is the leader in that area. So health care costs have really driven the discussion on health care reform, but I will also add that it's not just cost. It's looking at quality and how to deliver services in a better way, and I know Ken Thorpe will talk about that when he gets up to present to the committee, but this year, probably, I've been working on health policy for many years, and this year we probably are seeing more of a groundswell of states looking at broad-based reforms as opposed to incremental reforms, which is really what the states have been in the business of doing. You know, incrementally over the last 15 years, states have really changed the way that they've delivered health care in their respective states with incremental changes, and in some cases, in some states, that has made access to care easier for people with low incomes, and has made it easier for small businesses to obtain insurance. But we're seeing more interest in broad reforms. So including not just covering the uninsured, but looking at quality, looking at prevention, and looking at all the other aspects of our healthcare delivery system. So we'll go to the next slide.
Laura, before you do that, we have a couple questions. So Representative Gardner has a question first, and then Representative Seaton.
Thank you. I think we've all heard anecdotal stories about places that have universal health coverage, and there are long delays, lack of choices, denied services. And so my question is, I don't know if that's true or not, my question is, do the higher U.S. healthcare costs also correlate with better quality, more choice, a more timely delivery or access?
That's a very good question. When you look at the outcomes, so you look at the health of people living in the United States and the outcomes that are the result of interfacing that system, you see that the United States doesn't actually have the best health outcomes. We're kind of middle of the pack. So, no, that money is not buying the best quality of care. And I think through the course of today's presentations, you'll see that will be outlined for you. So you asked whether or not we're buying better quality. What we're buying is more services. So we use more services, therefore we spend more money. And we have a very big healthcare market. So there is a there is no shortage of you being able to get those services. And then you also referenced, you know, some of the anecdotal information about countries where they have single-payer systems, long waiting lines and such. And I will say that anecdotally, yes, that's out there. I can send to the committee, there is some work that's been done looking at comparisons of different countries' programs and sort of comparing quality and outcomes. And I can send that information, and then if you have additional needs, I could see if I can fill in the gaps. Because right now, I'm not really prepared to talk about the various countries' programs and how they compare to the United States, other than to say, yeah, there is a lot of anecdotal information out there that says, you know, Canada's system may be single payer and you may have access to services, but you may have to wait 4 months for those services to take place. So I think what I would like to do right now is just to say that I'll send you that information, and then we can have a conversation about that, or I can have a conversation about that with the full committee if that's desired.
Okay.
Is that all right?
Thank you very much, Laura, and then I'll make sure that all the committee members get that.
Okay.
And also, I just want the record to show that Representative Sisna has joined us, and Representative Mike Schnulte is in the audience, and you're welcome to come up here, Mike, and join us. And Representative Seaton has a question, and then Senator Dyson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On your graphs, there seems to be a divergence after 1980 between whether it's the trajectory or it's a divergence. Is that divergence, if you look at the healthcare as a percent of GDP by country or the previous one after 1980, is that related to specific policies either adopted by the United States or by basically all of the other countries?
I'm going to ask Dick if he has any insight on that.
Well, to be honest and accurate, I don't really have a good answer to that one. I have concentrated on United States healthcare finances and structure more than other countries. As Laura said, we do have backup material and analyses of the other nations, and so we'd be happy to share that kind of material with you. I mean, in terms of the United States line specifically, certainly there's been a, as that line indicates, I mean, first of all, it goes up fairly steadily. It's an increase in the sheer amount of health services available and provided, and in some ways managed care is described as a cost saver, but it also drew many more millions of people into an insurance setting so that they were simply using services. But again, rather than give a halfway analysis here, I think we'd rather provide you with some reliable data.
And I think also if we go to the next slide, that shows the annual change in total health benefit costs from 1990 to 2007. And so it's just looking at the same information, but specifically to the United States. And it shows the change in the benefit cost over the years. And you'll see that there was a spike in 2002 and in 1990, way back in 1990. And then you'll see that it's leveled off over the last 3 years at around 6.1%. So we are seeing some containment in cost, in total benefit cost, but it still outranks inflation and growth in wages. So it's still a concern for employers and for individuals who are out there purchasing health insurance. And I think you, as legislators on this committee, know that because that's why you're here today discussing, and I know that your constituents have been talking to you about it. So this is just to sort of set the stage, not really to delve into the data that has gotten us here, because I'd really like to get into what's going on across the country in healthcare reform.
Okay.
Shall I move on?
One more question. Senator Dyson has a question.
Yeah. Thank you, Madam Chair. Laura, thanks for helping us When you were talking a few minutes ago about the amount of money spent on health care and the outcomes, your discussion omitted the huge factor about cultural and environmental conditions, which I think vary hugely, and how much of a downside in our outcomes is because of behaviors, smoking, obesity, lack of exercise, and bad diets, and so on and so forth.
Madam Chair, if it's all right with you, I'd like to hold that question because I have some slides later on in the presentation that actually talk about the impact of those behaviors on healthcare costs and how they're influencing state health reform. So would that be okay with you?
We'll try to hold our questions back for about the next five slides, and then we'll start asking again. One thing I do want to ask myself is that in the United States, we have a tendency, there's more lawsuits, and so I think a lot of doctors will do more tests than they normally would. Like if someone comes into the ER, there's a lot more tests done just so that they make sure, and that has driven up healthcare costs also. Is that a factor at all?
I can send you some information on that. It certainly is a factor, and I think Dick can also give me information that I can send to you, which are the drivers of healthcare costs. And I'm sorry that I didn't include that. I have a few slides that show, you know, what are the indicators that drive healthcare costs, and I didn't include that in this presentation because it was already so very heavy with content. But why don't I send that shall I send it to Rebecca?
Yes, please do.
I'll send that information to Rebecca so that the committee has that.
All right. Proceed. We'll stop asking questions for a
while. I don't mind the questions. It's just I'm afraid we won't get through with the information that you asked me to present. So just stop me whenever you like. So I'm going to move on to the next slide, which is just a map showing coverage rates for the total population uninsured for 2004-2005. And you'll see where Alaska, hopefully you're looking at this in color, and you'll see where Alaska falls there. And this is someone who reported being uninsured at any time during the year. It's the U.S. Census data. And then if you'll go to the next slide, it shows, it's just a comparison. So it shows what percentage of those uninsured are near poor, so 100 to 199%. And you'll see that that's not the case in Alaska. You have a small amount of uninsured that are in the 100 to 199% rural poverty level. Moving on to the next slide, I've been looking at what's going on across the country, and there certainly is a lot of discussion happening across the country on broad-based health reform. And in an effort to be able to present this in a more organized way, I've categorized the recent state actions and proposals into four different categories. And then underlying all of those categories is really an underlying focus on cost containment. So states are looking at reducing the number of uninsured, and that's really what you're reading about in the paper. So that's what's getting a lot of the press coverage, and that's what's being talked about in State of the State addresses. And more and more governors and legislators are looking at programs that will be able to pull more people into an insurance product. So they're looking at reducing the number of uninsured, focusing on quality initiatives. So looking at the care that's being delivered and trying to make that care more efficient, more effective, and produce better outcomes. Focus on appropriate care for chronic disease. This is a biggie, and I know Ken Thorpe will talk about this, and it's been a very large component in many discussions across the country in many states, and looking at making chronic disease management a focal point of reforming the system, and I'll give you some examples. And then focusing on prevention and wellness initiatives. This is already We're seeing not just broad-based reforms and legislation that is broad in content, but we're seeing many states passing legislation even specifically on various items like reducing obesity, reducing smoking indoors, that sort of thing, which is a focus on prevention and wellness. And so we'll talk about that. And then concurrently, all of these are looking at long-term cost containment. So we'll go on to the next slide.
Laura, Representative Seaton or Representative Sisna has a question for you.
Laura, my question is that on your slide, and I don't know that it has a number, the near poor uninsured rates for the non-elderly, and looking at the poverty rate, I'm a little concerned here. That when we're looking at our situation, we really truly look at it clearly, and that is really problematic right now, as I understand it, because our state has just finished its survey, and well, it's actually still working on it, of the uninsured, and what they found is some very unusual factors in Alaska, it sounds like, and that was a report that we heard several different times, and our health caucus actually heard a description of it too, and that was that there's a very large number of Alaskans who it's hard to even get numbers on because, like, they're doing fishing jobs, they're doing seasonal jobs. And so it's hard to figure out where they're at, what their money situation is. They're really not even tracked by our state government. And the state is really looking at those numbers right now. But it's hard for us to really get a good assessment of exactly what we're working with. Have you heard about this? Because I think we've got to factor it in when we're looking at how does this particular state deal with the issue.
I haven't been privy to the information that you're speaking of, but what I would say is that it's absolutely essential that the state has good data before they progress with coming up with a plan that includes coverage of the uninsured, because the dynamics in the states are very, very different. And historically, you can see that one program that works for a certain population in one state may not have the same effect in another state because the dynamics of their uninsured are different. And so I would say that you would need that good data, and if you have conflicting data, it's just a matter of pulling it together and looking to your experts that are in the audience right there and figuring out what the demographics are of your uninsured. Nationally, the uninsured tend to be poor. They tend to be working, and a good percentage of them tend to have part-time jobs. And you were talking about the types of jobs that are available in Alaska where they might be more transient. So someone comes up, does a fishing, is a fishing guide for a certain amount of time, may not really be even documented as living in your state, but is actually using the resources that you have available for healthcare services. And that certainly is a challenge for you all to document that. But I think the best data you have will give you the best program that you can design. So I would encourage the committee to invest resources in good data.
Actually, we at our last meeting, we did have a report, and the report wasn't finalized, so it was a preliminary report of the uninsured. And there even all of our native population, they do have some a sort of health care through the native corporations, and they are counted as uninsured in that data.
Yeah, and I think knowing those nuances so that you can move forward is very important.
Yeah.
Anything else on that?
No, but I would like to mention that Representative Holmes has joined us, and you're welcome to come forward and set up the table with us. Thank you. Go ahead, Laura.
Okay, so I'm going to talk about the first bullet first, reducing the number of uninsured. So we'll go through several several different strategies that states are looking at to try to reduce the number of uninsured. The first one that we're going to talk about is the idea of a connector. Now, if you haven't been following what's going on in Massachusetts, Massachusetts and Vermont in 2006 passed broad-based reform. In 2003, Maine passed broad-based reform, but they've been they haven't been as successful in implementation as they would have liked to have been because of some hang-ups with financing. And then also, it's a voluntary program, and I'm going to talk about some of the lessons learned from Maine when we get to talking about an individual mandate. But let's talk about a connector first. So you should be looking at the slide that says the connector health insurance exchanges. The idea of a connector has been around for a while. The Heritage Foundation was one of the first organizations that started talking to states and actually the District of Columbia about the idea of a connector. Massachusetts passed legislation last year, and part of the legislation created a quasi-government organization, division, whatever you want to call it, that's governed by a board that is multidisciplinary, and they call it the connector. And what the connector does is it provides a single place for people to purchase insurance coverage. It also is the facilitator for their subsidized insurance product that was also created last year for low-income people. It allows for more transparency. So the connector is really about, they're in the business of educating people on the things that they need to know about purchasing good health insurance. The connector was also very, very much involved in writing the rules and regs for implementing the healthcare reform legislation that passed. And they were very involved in the discussion on affordability and what makes insurance more affordable. So they've been a real pivotal contributor to the implementation of the Massachusetts health insurance reform law. But the connector doesn't have to be part of broad-based reform, and we've seen some examples of states like Washington that have passed legislation to create a connector, but they did not include a lot of the other broad-based reforms that were included in the Massachusetts law. So there are a number of states now that are examining this in 07, and I have those states listed. In addition to connectors, the idea of a connector is to allow employers and employees to have access to affordable health insurance. And Massachusetts, in their legislation, required all employers to offer Section 125 plans. In doing so, that allows the employees to purchase insurance through their employer with pre-tax dollars, and the connector helps to facilitate that. And that's what Washington modeled in their legislation. Rhode Island and Missouri this year enacted separate cafeteria plan requirements, but they did not enact connectors. So they didn't create a connector or an exchange, but they are going to require employers to offer Section 125 plans in an effort to encourage workers to buy insurance with pre-tax dollars. Any questions on that? Okay. The Massachusetts connector, which is the next slide, we were just recently in Massachusetts because NCSL's annual meeting was there in August, and we had an opportunity to sit down with some folks and talk about how the implementation was going. And right now, they report that they have 15,000 new purchasers of insurance via the connector. Their individual mandate implementation began July 1st of 2007. And so since then, they have had 15,000 new purchasers via the connector and 165,000 newly insured. But that's net growth. So that, you know, it's the only number they could give us, but it isn't, that doesn't really indicate that there are 165,000 newly insured people. It could be people moving from one plan into one of the six plans that are available. The insurers pay a premium fee of 4% to the connector to do business with them. And then the other thing that Massachusetts did was they merged their small group and individual market. And right now what they're saying in Massachusetts is by doing that merger that there was about a 15% decrease for individual plans. That's the projection for the price of individual plans, and about a 1.4% increase in small group premium costs. They're hoping that makes health insurance more affordable for people who are out there on the individual market. So that's what I'm going to report on the connector. If you have any questions about that, I'd be happy to take them now.
Representative Brozos has a question.
Thank you. Have they been tracking how many people have dropped their own private insurance to be able to go through the employer connector insurance? Because I know you said out of 165 newly insured, that would also include those that dropped insurance that they had to go to a new plan. Have they been tracking that?
The connector is really, it's private insurance. So you're asking, have employers dropped non-connector insurance to go with the connector?
Yes, or individuals that have dropped their own private coverage that they had to now take coverage through the connector.
I'm going to have to ask them how their data. They didn't discuss that with us. We talked a lot about employers dropping group coverage, but we didn't talk about sort of the, you know, where people were purchasing. So I'll ask them that question. I think Dick, do you have anything?
I do not, no.
Okay, I'll ask them that question. That did not come up in the conversation, but we did have a good conversation about the dynamics of employer-sponsored insurance and whether or not they were seeing any decrease in employer-sponsored insurance, which I think broadly and for cost purposes and for crowd-out purposes, that was more of their concern at this point. So, but I'm going to write down that question and I'll email it to them and I'll get back to you. I'm sorry, but can you repeat your name? Because I can send it also directly to you as well as Rebecca.
Well, if you, I would like you to have it, send it to me or
through
Rebecca, because then we'll make sure everyone on the committee gets the answer to that question, because we all want to kind of hear it. And that way you will only have to send it to one person.
Okay.
The answer to your question, my last name is Roses, just like flowers.
Okay, and the insurance that's available through the connector is private insurance. There is a subsidized product that Massachusetts is subsidizing insurance up to a certain poverty level, but the rest of the insurance is private market insurance. It's private insurers that are offering it and participating with the connector.
Right, and I would say that in their case, for the private insurance, they would not think of it as a negative if somebody had what they thought was perhaps inadequate or imperfect insurance and used the connector to transfer to something they thought was better or more affordable.
But I will ask about movement. So I'll ask about, you know, dropping insurance that they had and moving into the connector. I don't know whether or not they have that data, but I'll certainly ask. The next slide is just an example of the connector's webpage. They did a lot of work to try to get the word out to the individuals in their state about the opportunities through the connector, and they created a very nice website where individuals can go not only for information but to also sign up for insurance. And I'm using this as an example for you all because one of the things that we've learned over the years is that how you market a program is so amazingly important in the success of that program. And, you know, New York, when they created some reforms a few years ago to create a program for small businesses, they didn't really market it effectively, and they had no participation in the first year or at least none compared to what they were hoping for. And after a good marketing plan and a little bit more effort to get the word out, they definitely were able to enroll more people in that program, and they were happier with their successes. So I think marketing and making sure that the communication is a direct line to those people that you're trying to reach out to is a very big part of not only creating your program, but also making sure that you have financing and resources built into the program to do an effective job. So let's go on to the next slide, which is reducing the number of uninsured by requiring all residents to buy health insurance. Massachusetts made it to the first page of all the major newspapers in the country by passing a law in 2005 that required all residents to have health insurance as of July 1st, 2007, with some exceptions. So they will provide waivers to individuals who can prove that they can't afford it. And proving that they can't afford it is based on a formula that the connector has come up with that that really equals about 6% of your income. And so although they're saying this is universal health care and that it is a broad-based individual mandate, everyone will have insurance, there will be individuals that won't, that will remain out of the insurance market. And it could be because they at that time can't afford the insurance that's being offered. Those cases will be taken into consideration. The way that they're monitoring this is through the income tax reform. And so when they file their income taxes, their state income taxes, there'll be a question there about their insurance, their health insurance status.
Laura, I have a question here because the question of affordability, many families I know, and so I'm wondering how Massachusetts is handling this because there's many families that are just, they're budgeted to the line of how they're going to pay their bills. And what's going to happen to the people that can't afford insurance if they so chose to, but they've got themselves budgeted up. They've got a car payment, they've got a house payment, they've got other maybe doctor's bills or whatever, and they actually don't have room to add anything else into their budget. What are they going to do with those people?
You know, affordability has always been a very, very difficult discussion when talking about health reform and getting the uninsured insured. It really is the sticking point. Cost, the cost of health care is what keeps people out of insurance, the cost of the premiums. And Massachusetts had a very, very long debate, many, many meetings to discuss the idea of affordability. And what they came up with was this formula that really ends up being about 6%. So if insurance is more than that, then you're waived out. However, in our discussions with some of the individuals involved in implementation, I do think that they are going to consider individual family situations. So let's say you had, you had a year where, there is a need for that money. You may not have the 6%, but there's a need for that money to pay for something catastrophic or something comparative. And they are going to take into consideration individuals' situations. But I also will tell you that this is just being implemented. You know, they just, the requirement just went into effect this July. So next year at this time, they'll have much more experience in determining this idea of affordability and waivers. And, you know, depending upon whose data you look at, there are some organizations that have been following this law that are saying that as many as 20% of the citizens in the state will be waived out of that requirement. It's really a wait and see. We're going to have to see. And Dick would like to add something here.
Oh, just a practical emphasis, which is, you know, certainly the Massachusetts plan and then the whole process of passing it in the legislature and then implementing it through rules has gotten a lot of attention. But I think I would emphasize that it's a very fluid situation, and they themselves would admit that up front. In other words, they've set some standards. They have regulations saying what the minimum cost of certain kind of policies will be per month. But those numbers are subject to very quick change to the extent they find that they're not working or they're not feasible. And working and feasible are two different things in the sense of, you know, how much money can the state put in of its own and what kind of feedback they're getting from the public. So really, bottom line I'm trying to say is just that the Massachusetts 2007 example is just that. It's one example. There's not a presumption that it's that the numbers, the dollar amounts, or the even the structure are the permanent answer for the next 5 or 10 years. Even there, that it wouldn't surprise me if in 2 years you see them readjusting the figures and changing the appropriation and so on.
And we have two more questions: one from Representative Seaton, and then one from Senator Dyson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The 6% formula test, was that 6% of net income or gross income? What was that 6% of?
I think right now I think it's net, but you know, we have this discussion and they're looking at it and saying that the affordability, there's a discussion about what should be taken into consideration for that, and there's a movement to try to include not just the cost of premiums but also the cost sharing. Do you see what I'm saying? So that in the formulary that it shouldn't just be the $150 for the premium, but the cost sharing as well. So this is all, like Dick said, it's all very fluid. But they're you know, by the end of this year, they'll have more experience and they'll have some lessons under their belt. But I think this is all under discussion. But I'm going to confirm that for you, okay?
Okay, follow-up, Representative Seaton.
Yeah, I'd appreciate it if you get back to us on that, whether it's, what line it's coming off of, if it's like the federal tax form, because it makes a huge difference for us to see what kind of comparison that makes, if it's net income or gross income.
Okay. Shall we go on?
Not yet. We've got a couple more. Senator Dyson's next.
Yeah, thank you. Laura, in Massachusetts, just seems to me that requiring everybody to have health insurance raises significant personal freedom and constitutional issues. Have there been any legal challenges there? And also, a second unrelated question, when in our culture did we make this paradigm shift that we, instead of people paying their own bills, that somehow or the other we've now made the assumption the only way out of our healthcare dilemma is to force everybody to have insurance as opposed to paying their own bills?
I'll address your first question, and that is, has there been any constitutional challenges? And the answer to that is no. Of course, there's been a lot of discussion about it, but no. No challenges to the law based on the individual mandate. And the idea behind the individual mandate was really about shared responsibility. And so when the legislature and the governor got together to create this program, they wanted the financial responsibility to be shared among employers who right now are bearing a large percentage of the burden. So employers, the public, and in Massachusetts, they had expanded their public programs pretty significantly, so the public was paying a large percentage of the health care dollar and individuals. And so they wanted it to be this triangle of shared responsibility. So that was the philosophy behind the individual mandate. The individual mandate philosophically and politically doesn't work for every state. However, there are those out there that would argue that without the individual mandate, implementing some of the market reforms and implementing and creating some of the programs that we're going to discuss today will never be as effective because of the way that health insurance works on a pool. And by trying to pull as many people into the pool as possible with an individual mandate, you expand that pool to the point where it it becomes more effective and you can get some cost reductions in premiums. Whether or not that's actually going to pan out and work in Massachusetts, we'll just see. As far as the, you know, the paradigm shift and, you know, moving towards individually mandated insurance, you know, I don't think this is anything new. There's been, I mean, the law is new, but the discussion around including everyone in insurance has been around for a long time. I
to order. It is 1:30 in the afternoon on August 28th, and we do have a quorum. And we have online with us, Barbara Hale is still hanging in there and is online with us. And we have, so far, we have Representative Seaton, Representative Gardner, Representative Keller, Senator Dyson, Representative Fairclough, and myself, Representative Wilson. And we're going to continue our health discussion this afternoon, and the next person up our next presenter is Dr. Ken Thorpe, and he's with the Robert Wood Woodruff. He is the Robert Wood Woodruff Professor and Chair of the Department of Health Policy and Management in the Rowland School of Public Health of Emory University in Atlanta. He also co-directs the Emory Center on Health Outcomes and Quality. And he's going to give us some insights into rethinking insurance. Dr. Thorpe has authored and co-authored over 85 articles, book chapters, and books. He's also a frequent commentator on healthcare issues in the printed media and television. He's appeared on Nighttime with Ted Koppel, NBC News with Tom Brokaw, ABC World News Tonight with Peter Jennings, CNN, CNBC, and others. Dr. Thorpe also received his PhD from Rand Graduate School and an MA from Duke University, and his BA is from the University of Michigan. And you have papers in front of you that are colored blue, and they are the ones that follow his PowerPoint. So, Dr. Thorpe, we will go ahead and let you do our presentation for us, and we will follow the same program as we did this morning. We will stop off and on for questions and let the record show also that Representative Roses has joined us. And we've got basically many people in the audience again with us today, and we thank you for being here. And if it's all right that we call you Ken, is that all right?
Absolutely.
Ken, would you just go ahead and I hope that that you've got some exciting thing for us to hear.
Well, we'll see what we can gin up here.
Okay.
Thanks for inviting me, first of all. It is absolutely a gorgeous day, my first time here, so I've enjoyed the couple of days I've spent here so far. Let me give you a little background before I go into this presentation. I spent the last 2.5 years now working with two states to enact fairly comprehensive health care reform efforts. Vermont, you heard a little bit about this morning, and we'll talk a little bit more about that. In the state of Illinois, which is in the process of introducing a basic restructuring of how they pay for and deliver health care services in that state. So I'm going to talk to you about some opportunities I think a state like Alaska could have to really pass broad-sweeping, comprehensive reforms that in both of these states turned out to be really not partisan issues. One state, Vermont, with a Republican governor and Democratic legislature, and Illinois with a Democratic governor. But I think as you'll see when we go through this presentation, a lot of the policy initiatives that I think are of interest and I think could be quite effective really are not issues of Republican or Democrats. They're really just issues in terms of common sense prevention and more effective management of patients that are driving health care in the system. So if you want to talk a little bit about that process as we go through it, I'd be happy to. I was the a consultant to the Vermont Health Care Commission, which is a legislative body tasked to brokering an arrangement on health care reform with the governor. and played a similar role in Illinois, though I came into the governor's office tasked to helping to develop a consensus proposal with the legislature. So it's a combination of, as you go through this, of having, I think, the problem defined right, having a right vision, and having, obviously, a political strategy of how to proceed. You know, one of the takeaways in both cases was certainly to get people on the same page, trying to solve the same problem, try to, obviously, the governor and the legislative leadership has to be engaged in this in really moving in the same direction. And you know, I think we have some good case studies of very successful healthcare reform efforts that, as we go through the presentation, be happy to talk about. You've heard a little bit about the components of healthcare reform. The four that I focus on is that, you know, a key issue for people when they think about healthcare reform is how are you going to make my health insurance less expensive, more affordable? What are we going to do to make sure that my employer continues to offer it at an affordable price with lower copays and deductibles? I start out with this one because I don't know the specific numbers in Alaska, but we've done some national polling in the last election looking at voters. And obviously, when you look at the voting public, nationally about 85% of Americans have health insurance, is close at 83% here. But about 96% of people who voted had health insurance. Mm-hmm. So when people are voting, and when you talk about health care reform, they're focusing on this stuff costs a lot, and we'd like to find some initiatives to make it less expensive, better quality, more quality time with my physician, and less complicated, because it is very complicated for physicians and families and others trying to deal with the forms and the paperwork involved in health care. So I think collectively these are areas that I know that you're touching on in different ways, the affordability issue, reducing the administrative costs. There are a lot of very simple things that we can do to move paper out of healthcare that produces no quality but produces higher costs. I'll give you some examples of that. There's some quality initiatives that we embedded in the both of Vermont and Illinois reforms that I think might be of interest here as well. And then obviously the debate about what do we do about the uninsured. Vermont is not dissimilar from this state in the sense that it has a lot of seasonal workers. It's a recreational economy, ski resorts, a rural state, although not nearly as rural as or big as Alaska. But certainly has some elements that are not dissimilar, about the same population size, something in the 600 to 660,000 range. Policy interventions on the affordability side, I can just tell you my experience working with the legislature in both of these states. I just started out the first couple of weeks just making sure that we understood the problem, understood the data, and understood the analysis about where we're spending our healthcare dollar and what's driving healthcare spending up. And I found that once we got everybody sort of bought into the data, the numbers, the analysis, the conversations we had about interventions were a little bit easier. So I think just the common sense issue is that, you know, crafting effective solutions that are going to make healthcare more affordable, a better value proposition, means that you have to have a clear understanding of where you're currently spending healthcare dollars and what's driving the growth and spending up. Real simple stuff, but, you know, I find when I go into a lot of different places and talk to policymakers, and I'll give you some survey data as well, most people really sort of misidentify or have notions of where we spend the money and why it's going up that turn out to empirically not be the fact. So that's an important shortcoming. If you're trying to solve the wrong problem, you're not likely to have much an effect on really making healthcare less expensive. I start out with these six framing issues. And this is largely dealing with the affordability issue. I call them the six unhealthy truths, which tell the story of the rise in chronic disease, impact on health, and healthcare in the United States. And I believe at the end of the presentation, the citations are there. If not, I'd be happy to give you the citations of the studies and so on that each of these come from. But I'll walk you through them as I go and tell you where they come from. First one, we know this is CDC data, that chronic diseases are the number one cause of death and disability in the United States. They account for 70% of deaths in the U.S. They kill more than 1.7 million Americans a year. So it is a leading cause of death. And, you know, I don't think that's tremendously surprising, and certainly I think everybody sitting here either may themselves have a chronic illness or certainly know of somebody or somebody in their family that has diabetes, high blood pressure, depression, heart disease, cancer. All of these constitute collectively a chronic, different forms of chronic disease. Second truth, again, these are data that that I've tabulated. They're also data from the CDC. Three-quarters of spending on healthcare nationally, and we can sort of do an estimate for Alaska as well based on the characteristics of the population and the demographics to see how much around the margin this number may vary. But chronic illness accounts for three-quarters of what we spend on healthcare. Now, I think that that's an important statement because, remember, somebody with a chronic disease by definition has an established medical condition that is expected to last at least 18 months, 2 years, or even longer. So these are people that have that are already ill. And at that point in time, the issue about insurance is important only in the sense of paying for services to make sure that services are delivered. What really is more important is how can we best and most effectively clinically manage that patient, both in terms of sending the patient to do a better job of self-managing his or her condition, and also providing the opportunity for physicians and nurses to work with patients to make sure that they do all the basic blocking and tackling, which is just the primary preventive work of monitoring and managing the course of these diseases. Medicaid, depending on the state, accounts for about 83% of spending. And Medicare owns the chronically ill population. Over 95% of spending in Medicare is linked to patients that have heart disease, cancer, and these chronic health care conditions. The third truth, this is looking at the growth in spending. We've done this now through 2004, and the numbers are pretty much the same. If you look at what we spent in 1987, compared to what we spent in 2000, healthcare spending increased by over $300 billion, went from $313 to $628 billion. This is among privately insured patients. Of that growth in spending, about two-thirds of it is linked to the fact that we are treating more and more people with chronic illness. So two-thirds of the growth in spending is due to the fact that we've had a dramatic increase in the prevalence of treated disease. Now, there's a variety of reasons why the prevalence of treated disease could go up. We could actually have a true increase in the number of people that have diabetes and have high blood pressure and have cancer, heart disease, and so on. So that's one reason. It could be that we're doing a better job of detecting disease. That's probably a good thing, that we're getting at patients earlier in the course of their chronic illnesses. Could be the technology is better to treat more patients today than we were treating 15, 20 years ago. That's certainly the case in terms of drug interventions for treating depression. Certainly the case with statins treating hypertension and elevated cholesterol. So what we've been trying to do, and this is all of these pieces here are based on work we've been doing at Emory, trying to decompose what's going on with spending increases so we can have a clear picture up front for policymakers to sort of really understand what's driving the growth in spending so that they can find the levers of opportunity from a policy perspective and attack them. We tried to sort of understand here on how much of the increase in spending were for issues that we could potentially intervene, that we had an opportunity to either modify behavior or have an effect on the prevalence of treated disease. And what we found is that if you take the issue of obesity, obviously, a big piece today in the Anchorage paper about obesity rates in Alaska. Just as a side, let me just tell you that most of those data are based on self-reported information. So people are sort of filling out surveys and asking, how tall are you? How much do you weigh? And it turns out nationally that when you do it that way, the prevalence of obesity is about 1 in 4, about 25% roughly. It's gone up. If you actually do it clinically, actually have a nurse come in and weigh somebody and take their height measurements, the prevalence of obesity is about 35%. There's about a 10 percentage point gap between the self-reported data in the actual clinical data, and that's not probably because people are saying they're too short. They're fudging a little bit on the margin with the weight side. But that's something that the numbers are even worse than what the self-reported data showed. We're bridging up to 35% nationally in terms of obesity rates, much higher than what the self-reported data indicate. What we wanted to do on this was to say how much of the increase in spending over time is due to the fact that we've had a established doubling of obesity among adults. And so we're just, this first part we're just doing among adults, and we're looking at it among kids too.
Okay. And we have a question, Representative Faircloth.
Thank you. In the previous slide, could you tell me if...
Meeting back to order. And right now, I would like to introduce our next presenter. And our final presentation will be by Jim Frog. And he's from the Center of Health Transformation, where he serves as the center's chief liaison to state policy projects. Prior to joining the center, Jim was director of the Health and Human Services Task Force at the American Legislative Exchange. Jim's op-eds have appeared in the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, the Chicago Sun-Times, and the Washington Times. He's also appeared on ABC's Good Morning America, CNBC's Bullseye and Power Lunch, NPR's All Things Considered, and many others. Jim holds a Master's of Philosophy degree from Cambridge University and a Bachelor of Arts with honors from the University of Southern California, and he now lives in Arlington, Virginia. And his presentation is the white one that we have before us. And so, Jim, we are looking forward to what you have to tell us. So if you could go ahead and start your presentation, and we will again take questions as we go along.
Okay, great. Well, thank you very much. It's good to see you again. It's been 24 hours. I'll do my best to add a little variety to what you heard. And good to see Senator Dyson and now Representative Keller. It's a big promotion for you, and I'm glad you still remember the little people you knew before you had such power. But I know it's been a long day, so I'll get through this fairly quickly and then get to questions, but feel free to ask questions at any point. When we talk about health transformation, we want to talk very broadly. What people normally talk about when they talk about health care reform are things like raising deductibles, raising co-payments, adding another formulary, restricting access to prescription drugs. That's it. That's not the kind of transformation that's needed. That's silly. That's not futuristic. So what I'm going to do in the course of the next few minutes is define what I mean by saying a 21st century intelligent health system. That's describing the circle. So we'll spend our time defining that and then how we can get there, and show a couple examples of groups and organizations that are already there and having tremendous success delivering better care at lower cost, which are not mutually exclusive. You can do better at lower cost. So that's, I think, what everybody wants, and it can be done. Health before health care. This is the most important thing. I think some previous speakers have alluded to this. But if people aren't sick, they're not expensive. At the policy council yesterday, one of the facts that were voted on by a previous meeting was 90% of heart disease is due to preventable behaviors. 90% of health disease, is relative to preventable behaviors, by bad diet, bad exercise, and a range of things like that. If you can just promote better activities earlier on, people aren't going to get sick. And most importantly, they're going to have a much better quality of life, and they're not going to be in the emergency rooms, they're not going to be costing more. So we have a healthcare system and a healthcare debate that tends to focus on treating the symptoms and very little on the root causes. This slide I like, and it contrasts a little bit with the one right after it, but there's one thing about this slide and the next one that are absolutely in sync, and that's what I want to highlight. This is from the Journal of the American Medical Association a couple years back, and it said, this is what determines your health status. My health status, each individual's health status is determined by these things. Behaviors, so use of tobacco, use of alcohol, movement deficit disorder, it's a fancy way of saying too much television. They always try and make simple things sound so much more complicated. They say genetics is 30%. Environment, public health, that's things like clean water, clean air, that kind of stuff. And 10% is healthcare delivery. So hospitals, clinics, what doctor you go to is only 10% of your health status. Now that tends to be where all of our arguments are, right? Most of our arguments, I should say, are about the 10%. and too little about the other 90. You can't do much about the genetics, although that'll probably change in the next few years, but for now we'll say we can't. Now, this is another Mediators of Health put together by Al Tarlov, who was a longtime professor at Harvard University. Now he runs a department down at Rice in Texas. And he says that society and relationships are 55% of health status. Now, that sounds kind of a little out there, a little strange, maybe a little touchy-feely, but I think there's a lot of legitimacy to that. What kind of family environment you're in? Do you have a lot of stress with your family, a lot of stress with your work? Do you react to stress worse than other people? These things really matter. You know, if you have an annoying colleague that sits in the cube next to you, I don't want any of you to respond to that. You probably get yourselves in trouble. Probably you have a lot of annoying colleagues in the cubes next to you. That can be very stressful and add to your day, and in the long term really can impact your health. They say health behaviors, you know, that's things like tobacco use and alcohol and diets is about 20%. The other one said it was higher, it's about 40%. Genetics and biology, this guy says it's only 10%, which is much lower than even 30. But look at what's the same, or almost the same, 15% is medical care. The other one said 10. Now, both of these great researchers and these people that follow this for a living say that what doctor you go to, what hospital you go to, what kind of care you get is 10 to 15% of what determines your health status. Now, that's pretty important to understand because we spend all of our time, a lot of partisan bickering and yelling and screaming over the pieces that actually have the least impact on our health status. And it's interesting to note that there are islands in the South Pacific where people have longevity rates as long as we do in the United States, and they don't have an MRI machine for a 2,000-mile radius. It's not because, I mean, America has by far the best medical technology in the world. There's no doubt about that, best medical technology in the world. But we don't have the longest longevity rates. Now, I would argue longevity rates are not the best indicator of health systems, but that's kind of beside the point, because what is a health system is a whole other conversation. Almost everyone in the room would disagree on that definition. But longevity and quality of life, I think, are very critical. But I think when you look at medical care having such a small impact on individuals' health status, it's important to focus more on the broader things and important to focus on the roots as opposed to just treating the symptoms. So I'm going to give you a series of ideas. We're at the Center for Health Transformation. We do everything we can to talk about solutions. We're not going to ever give a long presentation about the current system or the problems. Now, that's all you get all the time. People can come in and tell you all about the current system, tell you all about the problems. We try and give you specific solutions, and ideally ones that are either cheap or free and that have huge impact on health status. So the number one most important thing you can do over the long term to promote health is promote exercise and good diets in kids. That's the number one most important thing you can do, and you can do it in a couple ways. One, you can challenge your school districts to mandate physical education and junk-free food campus. There shouldn't be a public school anywhere in the state that sells Coca-Cola on campus, whether out of vending machines or whether at the line. I mean, they should not do that. And if people want to do it on their own, that's certainly their own business. But taxpayers shouldn't have to subsidize or even be party to that. Kids that consume food like that and processed sugars, now that's a terrible impact over the course of their health status over the long run. And as I'm sure you are all well aware, just there was a report this morning on the front page of the newspaper that we're a nation that's getting increasingly obese. I guess Alaska's not quite as bad as some others, but every state is bad and it's getting worse. And you just can't have a healthcare system where 12-year-olds are getting adult-onset diabetes. No healthcare financing system, no healthcare technology is going to be able to handle a system where obese 12-year-olds that aren't moving. There's no way to ever impact over the long, but you can impact by creating better behaviors in early ages. One particularly creative solution that I've seen around the country is in West Virginia, and it would be even more applicable here in Alaska, because I understand there's days where there's a lot of snow up here and it's really cold. I've never been here in the winter. I've only been in the summer, and I've never seen it below 60 degrees, so I'll assume that it really gets really cold here and snowy in the wintertime. But in West Virginia, they use PlayStation's Dance Dance Revolution, which if you've never heard of it, I never knew what this was until Christmas. It's a video game, and you get the equivalent of a Twister mat, and on the screen, little arrows come down, and then they play songs, and you're supposed to move your feet to the music. It's very difficult. My 10-year-old niece danced circles around me at the easiest level when I tried this for the first time at Christmas, but it gets kids moving, and it's a video game. You basically trick them into exercising. And my understanding is, I don't play video games, but the next generation of video games, a lot of them are movement-based. They're boxing, we're actually moving. They're dancing, we're actually dancing. They're guitar playing, where you actually have to, well, at least move your fingers. But those are a great way, especially when people aren't able to go outside and exercise, to get people to exercise inside. And it's fun. It's fun to do. And if you were creative and ambitious, you could probably get away for, you know, don't need to donate it to you or give it to you for a low cost, or, you know, say we want to make this part of our physical education system in the States. In the state, they'd probably be interested in doing that. And the other thing is, bad food in poor neighborhoods is a serious impediment to health. If a low-income person only has $3 to spend on a meal, they're going to spend it somewhere for 1,200 calories and not on something that may be a lot healthier, but it's only 300 calories. So that's a discussion we could get into later. But if people live in neighborhoods where the only access to food is very bad food, then it's going to be very hard to impact their health status over the long run. These are just 9 surprising diabetes risks. Watching 2 or more hours of television a day, drinking 1 soda a day increases at almost 100%. Skipping breakfast, a major bout of depression, a large waist, even if you're at normal weight. Waking up in the middle of the night, eating fast food more than twice a week. High stress, consuming a lot of processed meat. These are just a couple things that are worth throwing out there that most people don't associate with diabetes. But adult onset diabetes type 2 is increasingly common. And Governor Huckabee, who's now running for president, as a lot of people know, had early indications of adult-onset diabetes and then decided he was really going to change his lifestyle. He started running, he lost 100 pounds, and now he runs marathons and even written a book about his experiences. But that's an example of one person who changed their behaviors, and as a result has been considerably healthier. Silver Sneakers is another program. There's a lot like this. I'm just picking this one because it's people have heard of it. Some people have heard of it. But it encourages people, particularly older people, to exercise. It gives a free fitness membership for seniors. A lot of insurance companies contract with it. Participating fitness centers throughout the U.S. while traveling. There's customized classes, health education seminars. But 30% lower costs for Silver Sneakers members on average, but much lower for those who attended 4 times a week. So exercise is particularly healthy. And it's particularly good for older women who are alone. Now, women tend to outlive us guys, but the biggest risk they have is when they're alone, they get depressed and they get to take drugs. And you know, there can be a downward spiral that's very, very negatively impacted on, very negative impact on their health. So the idea of getting people together to exercise, maybe to walk around the mall 3 times a week if it's a cold day out, most malls would be happy to let you do that at 6 or 7 in the morning before their stores open. Not only is it exercise, but it gets to the other slide I showed earlier about society and relationships. People are isolated, get depressed, partly because they don't move, but partly because they're not out meeting people and chatting with people and making friends. Again, this sounds a little foofy and a little, you know, little simplistic, but it's very, very true. And there's lots of studies, and I can give you more than just this, of people who get out and exercise, especially older single women, who show marked improvements in health status. I have a great aunt, who just turned 100 in April. She lives in Long Beach, California. And I don't see her too often. I live on the East Coast now, but I didn't even realize this, but there was an article about her in June for her 100th birthday in her local little paper. And I never knew she did this, but apparently she leads a walking group in her neighborhood for, you know, she's outlived her husband by, I think, something like 50 years. But she leads a walking group in her neighborhood for all kinds of people. It's mostly older people, but it can be anyone. And apparently no one can keep up with her. She's 100 years old. And I would go out on a limb and say her superb health status is due largely to the fact that she moves so much. I mean, she's a little wiry thing, probably 5 feet tall and 98 pounds. But she walks all the time, and she's in great shape, and she's really energetic. And I think you contribute a lot of that to the fact that she moves and the fact that she has a lot of friends. So what is consumerism in healthcare? We're going to jump ahead a little bit more here. Consumerism in healthcare, this is how we make purchases in other areas that are non-health. Consumerism is how you bought your car, your personal computer, your last vacation, chose your child's college. You gathered as much reliable information as possible and then made a decision based on price, convenience, and what you value. So this isn't some crazy radical notion, and this is how we buy pretty much everything else in our life. And every day that goes by, there's more information available to us for free on the Internet. So we don't just have to ask friends or neighbors, although colleagues, well, we all do that. But there's opportunities to find more information online. So what is healthcare consumerism specifically? It's when employers, insurers, hospitals, physicians, drug and device manufacturers, and individuals, patients, know and share accurate price and outcome data for all players. And I'll come back to that in just a minute. It is bottom-up, where providers respond to empowered, informed patients. Individuals, employers, and insurers all have strong incentives to promote wellness, prevention, and early testing. We'll come back to that, too. I have a couple examples of that. And is better for all people, particularly those with multiple chronic conditions. I think one of the biggest myths you hear is that when you move towards consumerism, it's just good for the young and healthy. And that's true for particular vehicles if they're designed really poorly. But consumerism actually works best for the people who are sickest and their ability to buy care and choose what's best for them. So since I'm talking to several politicians here, this is a good stat for you. Do you have the right to know cost and quality information about your healthcare provider? That's a 93% yes. By contrast, should we leave God and the Pledge of Allegiance only comes in at 91. So there's probably not too many people out there campaigning around, you know, we should really take God out of the Pledge of Allegiance, but campaigning against people's right to know cost and quality information would be even worse than that. But this is, we do a lot of polling. Actually, we got another poll that's coming out in a couple of weeks on Medicaid. I'll come back to that in a minute, too. But this is a great issue, right to know. Do people have right to know cost and quality information about hospitals, about physicians, and about others that are in the system? These are two examples of what they do in Florida, and I would encourage all of you who are interested in this to go on these websites, floridacomparecare.gov and myfloridarx.com. floridacomparecare.gov, you can get price and outcome data for all procedures in all hospitals in the whole state for free. It costs the state about $200,000 to run these websites a year. So this isn't even like some big, giant millions and millions of dollars in investment. All they do is post data that they already collect, put it online. When it went live, it's been about 2 years now since they've had it up. There was no marketing campaign. They didn't run commercials. The governor wasn't out talking about it. But they got 70,000 hits on the first day, and people became aware of it extremely quickly. And you know, when you post results from hospitals, half of them are going to be below average, right? Half of anything is below average. So the hospitals that were below average weren't really happy about it too much. And the ones that were happy didn't offset the ones that were really angry about their results being posted.
Jim, after I saw this yesterday, I asked, because there was a representative of the hospital association there yesterday, so I went over and asked him if the hospitals would be, you know, for this or against it, and he said they've actually talked about it here in Alaska, and that they just would like to have some kind of input about how it's implemented, but they realize that it's coming.
Yeah, and it's important that it's done in the right way. It has to be risk-adjusted because different hospitals have different patient mixes. So you can't say, you know, Hospital A had 40% people dying from heart surgery and the hospital, you know, D only had 1%. There may be huge differences in what kind of populations they're dealing with, and that needs to be taken into account. One of the a couple years ago, I did a presentation for about a dozen hospital CEOs from New Jersey, and I had a slide similar to this. I mean, at that time, I wasn't familiar with the Florida websites, but at the time, we had the insurance company that I personally had a hospital data ranking. Oh, thank you. That you could get, and I showed some of the hospital data to the CEOs. There were about a dozen CEOs in the room, just a small room like this. And I showed them, and said, I just picked a couple hospitals at random because I'm not from New Jersey. I've barely even been there. I don't know much about it. I just picked a couple. I said, these are the results for this Princeton Hospital. This is one for the Trenton Hospital. And these guys were just livid. I mean, had I insulted their mothers, they would have been less angry with me. Oh, that's so wrong. You know, that's a hard. I mean, they were just, I had like 45 slides, and that was about my 21st slide. And we spent the next hour on this one slide. They were just infuriated with me. And when they calmed down, they never really calmed down, but when they quieted down, I said, look, my purpose of this showing you this isn't that it's accurate. I don't know if it's accurate. I'm not an expert. I'm not claiming that it's accurate. But I am saying, as a patient, this is all the information I have, so I'm probably going to use it. If you can do a better job, do it. Do it. Help me help you. How can you get us this information in a way that's friendly to you? If you're not going to do it, we kind of have no choice but to do it to you, but we would like you to do it on your own. So hospitals are not the enemy here. I mean, I don't want to make the, you know, hospitals where we all need emergency. We all need hospitals. We're all patients. But they have to come up with a way to do this. And Florida does it this way. It seems to work. It's been 2 years now, the Florida Hospital Station. They certainly didn't endorse it when it first came out, but they've learned to live with it. And what they've been able to do, and there's a lot of anecdotal stories about this now, is hospitals that had particularly bad ratings in certain areas, and they had 15 quality ranking areas at first, and it's expanded since then. If they were good on 12 and maybe not so good on 3, they would put together internal strike forces and try and fix themselves in the other 3, which is great. That's exactly the effect you're hoping to have, is sunlight creates different behaviors, and you want people to get. And again, this goes back to the same thing as politically saying is, you know, your right as a patient, your right to know which hospital is more likely to kill you is greater than the right of the hospitals to keep it secret. And if you want to argue with me on that, please do, because you're going to lose. That's a really easy fight to win. But, again, you want to do it in such a way that works for them. Now, don't let them drag their feet indefinitely, because it's not impossible to do anymore. I mean, there's a whole state. Minnesota does it. Minnesota actually does a really interesting job similar to this. But it's great information to have. And you have the cover of a 93% issue as well. So the results of healthcare consumerism, if done right, this is what you'll have: more choices of higher quality at lower cost with greater convenience. Think cell phones, personal computers, flat screen televisions. Every year that goes by, those items, I just picked those three because everyone's familiar with those, you get more choices of higher quality at lower cost with greater convenience. I mean, think of the most cutting-edge cell phone in the year 2001. Maybe it cost $500, $600 at the time. You couldn't give it to any 14-year-old today because they'd be embarrassed to show it at high school. It wouldn't have colors on it. It wouldn't have games on it. It wouldn't have downloadable ringtones. I mean, think of the rapidity of cell phones and how the technology, I mean, if you don't get a new one every year, you're way behind your neighbors and your colleagues and everyone else. But healthcare doesn't function like that. And I would add that beware this absurd myth. I don't hear too many people use this anymore, but occasionally you hear this. You can't shop for health care while you're lying unconscious. I mean, people actually do say this. Emergency rooms will tell you half, roughly, give or take. People that show up in emergency rooms aren't even emergencies. It's something like 99% of interfaces we have with the healthcare system are not emergencies. And even when they are, there's an opportunity usually for people around to make decisions as well. Of course, if you're lying in a snowdrift and had a heart attack and there's no one around, you can't shop for a hospital. But that's a tiny, tiny, tiny minority of interfaces with the health system. And most people have the opportunity to shop around most of the time. And we had an example of last summer. Some friends and I were playing football, and one of our friends fell and hurt his knee pretty badly, and he was in a good deal of pain and really was in no position to make a decision on where he needed to go to the emergency room. But the 20 of us standing around him decided where to take him. Let's take him to GW Hospital. Well, that one's, you know, what about the Arlington Hospital? What about the one on the hill? This is right by the Washington Monument. And so the 20 of us that were not in pain were able to decide, over the course of 2 minutes, decide where to take him. And so after he was taken to the hospital, I said to my friend, I said, well, that was a great example of healthcare consumerism. And he said, what is wrong with you? What does that even mean? I said, well, you have to come see one of my slide presentations one of these times. He said, no. So I won't go through all these. I'll just highlight a couple. But when I talked earlier about what the circle is, this is one outline of what the 21st century intelligent health system is. Individual-centered, values-driven, 100% coverage. Certainly we want a system where everybody is covered. I'll mention on that one, too. In Switzerland, they have a very interesting system. This is one thing I didn't mention yesterday. In Switzerland, they have 100% coverage. Everyone has a plan. What they do there is it's not based on what employer you have. There's a mandate you have to buy coverage. But what people do there, there's something like 75 insurance companies, so people have different abilities, different choices, is they sign contracts with insurance companies. So you might go to Alaska Blue Cross and sign up for 5 years or 10 years, or, you know, burn Blue Cross if they have such a thing in Switzerland. And at the end of those 5, 10 years, the contracted period, if you're actually healthier, you get money back. So it's an incentive of the health plans, your incentive to actually be healthier, But what the plan knows is that you're going to be with them for 5 or 10 years. So they actually care a lot more about your health status. I mean, the way it works now, the average 32-year-old had 9 different jobs. That was true for me when I was 32. In fact, it was exactly true. Exactly 9 different jobs by the time I was 32. But every time you change jobs, you probably have a new health insurer. You probably have a new network. You may get a job where there's no coverage offered. You may have a period of unemployment. In the Swiss system, none of that matters because it's not connected to your employment at all. And for people who are low income, they get a subsidy to buy the plan of their choice. They have 100% coverage. That's a very unique system. And the incentives are on the insurers and the individual to be healthier. And Switzerland is actually one of the healthiest countries in the world. Transparent price and quality information. Yeah, I wanted to back up 1 second and on this one, the myfloridarx.com, I skipped over that. They list the prices of the 100 most commonly prescribed drugs at all pharmacies.